have seen, O Lord, do not be silent. O Lord, do not be far from me. Wake up. A little over a year ago, in Paradise, California, little Lydia Schatz, aged 7, was beaten to death by her adoptive parents. According to the official report, she was beaten because she mispronounced a word during her homeschooling session. She was beaten because her parents, said that God wished it. And because the book they followed to train up a child by a group called No Greater Joy Ministries, no less, encouraged them to. For 7 consecutive hours, Kevin and Elizabeth Schatz flogged their daughter with a plumbing supply tube fashioned after a biblical rod, lashing Lydia again and again, ultimately to her death. Court records indicate that the only time they ceased striking her was for prayer. Evidently, little Lydia's prayers were never answered. How long, O Lord, will you look on? You have seen, O Lord, do not be silent. Wake up. A little over a day ago, in Ra'at al-Numan, Syria, Sheikh Mohammed Farhoun lost 18 family members in a single blast. 18 family members when an airstrike leveled his aunt's house. Nearby, a 12-year-old girl lost her pregnant mom and both of her siblings when a shell exploded into her home. The UN estimates that more than 1,400 children have been killed inside Syria over the past year. Many more maimed, boys as young as 10, imprisoned and tortured. How long, O Lord, will you look on? Wake up. Just how many souls throughout history have whispered or screamed this prayer only to be met with silence? Where is God when children are abused? When predators roam campuses? When mothers emotionally damage and fathers physically scar? Where is God when anyone is abused, when these unspeakable horrors occur? And what possible answers can we even dare to articulate when confronted with this huge and most damning big question? Many answers have been given, but to unpack them all would have us lingering here on a topic none of us want to linger on. So let us instead examine the 3 most popular solutions, identifying both their strengths and indeed their weaknesses. Solution number 1 to our big question says that life is a test, and nothing happens devoid of reason. Our fates have been determined, our fates and challenges elected by God. And it's what we make of these paths, and indeed of our hardships, that will ultimately judge how our life is to be measured. Therefore, God might not prevent child abuse, but God will be at work in the abuse, so to improve him or her down the road. According to the Internet Authority, Yahoo Answers, this is the best resolution to our big question, the one most voted on. Certainly, we all can quote annals upon annals of anecdotal evidence that verify this claim. We all know people who have matured and bettered themselves after going through a rough patch. People who have surrendered control to God after first destroying their bodies with controlled substances. We all know of children who have emerged happier and well-adjusted after treading through the muddiest rivers of parental divorce. Sure, we can all name people like that who have passed the test, and praise God for that. opportunity for passing. How can one's life be considered an exam when before they even write their name on the test, they have been erased? See, this answer, which says that life is a designed test, only really works for those who have survived, those counted amongst the living, those of us who remain. And yet, even for them, it doesn't always mean that life is at all still worth living. Take the book of Job, for example. Even though in the end of Job, in the 42nd chapter, Job is rewarded for all the abuse and heartache he had to go through. He's rewarded with a new wife, new job, multiple kids, everything supposedly great. He is still said to have died old and full of days. And I preached an entire sermon on this, I won't do it again. He died old and full of days, which can only be inferred as a state of reflective disharmony. And lest we forget, Job's beginning, the designated resource for life being a test, wasn't all that pleasant either. For you might recall from our text this morning that poor Job finds himself squarely in the middle of a divine bragging contest. Picking up from verse 7, Satan appears before God, talking a little trash, boasting a little about where he's been and what he's been up to, and God is like, yeah, but what about my servant Job? You haven't gotten to him. Satan answers, yeah, that's because you put a wall around him. How can anything go wrong for him? What does he have to complain about? You've protected him. So overtaken with bravado, God says, even if I take those walls down, even if you extend your hand, touch everything that he has, he will still worship me. And thus, a divine wage was formed between God and Satan, simply to prove a point. God handed Job, his blameless servant, over to become evil's pawn, all to see if he could prove a test, and thus prove God right. Hell of a test there, God. Additionally, if we take the scholarly approach instead of my exaggerated street language and dive deeper into the text, God still emerges as the man behind the curtain of Job's suffering. You see, the translation Satan is rather loose in its academic integrity, as the Hebrew word being employed here is actually Hasatan, or the Satan. Not a proper name, but rather a title describing a function. Thus, several commentaries suggest that it's more accurate to think of Hasatan, Satan, not as the devil, not as a divine adversary, but rather as God's divine instrument. So that when you read verse 7 and Hasatan's response to where he's been and what he's been up to, and you're wondering why is it so casual in its language and its tone, it's because he is simply reporting back to his boss, who had put him there to begin with, to carry out his appointed role as accuser and judge of the righteousness of humanity. Is this really, then, the best, most popular answer to our question? Do we really want to believe that God has commissioned Hasatan, Satan, the devil, whatever, to accuse and judge us, even to inflict pain and cause death to our loved ones, just to see if we can pass a test, just so God can win his celestial bet? No thanks. Solution number 2. Satan is real and has dominion over this earth. God and Satan are fighting for our allegiances, and we have been given the freedom to choose right over wrong, good over evil, God over the devil. Therefore, when children are abused, it is either because Satan has won influence over our corruptible humanity, This is answer number two. Obviously, the first half of this answer presupposes that you believe in the existence of the devil, which is itself a question. Kind of like the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis played out in real life, many believe that the root of our evil stems explicitly from foreign persuasions beyond our own control. It also supposes that God is not necessarily stronger than the devil. Rather, that both have legitimate power when vying over our collective consciousnesses. Our text from Matthew this morning in verses 8 to 10 support this claim. You might remember that Jesus is taken up to the highest point. He's taken to the highest point in the wilderness by Satan. And when he gets up to this highest point, Satan shows him all the kingdoms of the world and all of their splendor. Satan says to Christ, "All these I will give you if you fall down and worship me," implying that these kingdoms are under his command, not Christ's, not God's. Now, the first problem with this answer, this solution, is that if we say that God is omnipotent, all-powerful, then why not just remove Satan and his temptations from this world? Why allow Satan to stay on an equal footing? Knowing that we are corruptible in our humanity, why allow for such a demon to roam the earth, controlling both individuals and empires that can be put to such ill use? Or is this once again just a grand test to see who amongst us can dismiss Satan's temptations as Christ did in the wilderness? But that in and of itself would imply that God has indeed allowed Satan to do as he pleases, perpetuating abuses wherever he chooses. Either way, God here in this answer is impotent or indifferent. And surely that's a theological problem. The next problem that arises within this answer provides child abusers with an escape clause. It wasn't me. Satan that made me do it. It strips us of our accountability and responsibility to our other, for it suggests that the evil we've done was really not the evil of ourselves, but rather that of a foreign persuasion that was controlling us from the outside. It also suggests that God is tied up somewhere in a corner, while Satan is coercing someone to abuse that child or commit any other sin for that matter. The last problem with the solution harkens back to the problem we had with our first answer. Namely, that if God is the giver of free will, and God willfully opened the door for sinful behavior to exist, even in the darkest forms of child abuse, in doing so, it puts into question God's omniscience and benevolence. For if God is all-knowing and all-good, then God should have known what was to come when freedom escaped from his Pandora's box. It's because of the inconsistencies and uncomfortable conclusions of these first two answers that many find comfort in our final and third solution. Solution number three. Either A, God does not exist, B has retired, or C is active in a manner unorthodox or unknown to how we normally conceive. Part A, uncomfortably, is rather clean and simple. For it argues that God allows child abuse to occur simply because there is no God to begin with. And with God and cosmic benevolence out of the picture, there also goes an objective and universal code for morality. Without objective morality, then there's nothing left to impede these abuses outside of societal law. Knowing, however, that the majority of us here are not atheists, let us examine parts B and C and finally get going with the sermon. The idea that God has retired is not new, nor, however, is it usually preached. It asks us to look at the world, witnessing all the evil and despair that happens, 14, Christ tells the disciples during his farewell discourse that when he leaves, the Advocate, the Spirit of truth, will come, and will be this Spirit, not Christ, that lives both with and in them. Christ also makes it clear that this Spirit will teach and comfort, but it will not act. It will internally aid, but it will not force your hand or your mouth. More, Christ tells that the world at large will not see or know that the Spirit even exists, principally because there will always be those who freely choose sin and hatred and thereby reject this Advocate. Thus, the Advocate will only abide in those who are pure and innocent, those who righteously believe, those who live according to God's commandments of love and peace. Accordingly, the reason then why the abuse of children persists is because God and Jesus have left this world, and that only the Advocate remains, who is not known by everybody, who does not determine or impose upon our actions, but who rather comforts those who abides within. Is this really our best answer? I don't know. Why wouldn't Christ just return and make this easy? I don't know. Why won't God, in all of God's power and majesty, intervene? Why, God, are you looking on in silence? Surely this Advocate isn't enough. I know. Where is God when children are abused? I can't say